I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview was an absolute delight. It's with director Ursula Antoniuk, and we talked about her new film, Beyond Words. But in a way, we talked very little about the film. It's a stunning, gorgeous portrait about two lawyers working on refugee cases in Germany. And this is a film about getting beyond words, it seems to me. This is a film about identity, and it's about empathy. It's about communism. It's about love and self-creation. We talk about poetry and contrast and juxtaposition, and Slavoj Žižek makes his way into the conversation. I mean, what's a conversation without some thinking from Slavoj Žižek? We talk about plot and film and proposition and about how all of this plays into the story and the way it's told. We talk about relationship and mystery and parenthood. It's a wonderful film, and you're going to need to see it. And I trust you're going to enjoy the interview coming right up about the new film Beyond Words. DavidPeckLive.com for more information about my writing and speaking. FaceToFaceLive.ca for a whole new host of interviews there, and also Rabble.ca for information on from a Canadian perspective. About the world we live in and issues that matter. Coming right up, Ursula Antoniuk and her new film, Beyond Words. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by another very special guest here at the Toronto International Film Festival. With us here today is Ursula Antoniuk, here to talk about her new film, Beyond Words. Thank you, Ursula. Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you for Royal York Hotel here in downtown Toronto on this beautiful day. Is it the world premiere tonight?
Yeah, this world premiere. I have a European premiere of my film in San Sebastian, but I also have a Polish premiere in Gdynia. So, and also a couple of other festivals, but this is the first viewing today after 5 years of fighting for a film.
After 5 years of fighting for the
this
film.
This is the day.
So how are you feeling right now about that? Before we get into talking about the film, we've talked a little bit about it before the recorder started, but...
Of course, I'm very nervous, but it's kind of exciting way.
Yes.
I'm very curious how people will react, and curious in a way, like anxious, but also genuinely curious. You know, I like Q&As with audience, because I also like to ask questions to the audience.
Not only
get the questions from the audience.
Right.
But also very practical. For example, one of the first questions I always ask the audience is like, Were you bored by the film?
Were you bored by the film?
Yes, because I think it's the greatest, mistake, you know, of the filmmaker when you make a film that doesn't engage the audience, you know.
Interesting. Yeah. So boredom is high on your list as a filmmaker, as a storyteller.
Yeah. I mean, there are filmmakers that something like people call a slow cinema that uses the boredom as a kind of. As a kind of a tool.
A tool, yep.
But we are talking about very, very special filmmakers, you know, who can do that and actually know how to do that. But it's not about only about the length, you know, it's not about the slowness that makes it non-engaging. But for me, non-engaging film is a film that doesn't go deep, you know, that it's shallow in a sense, like the film wants to only tell you the story, but the story doesn't have what I call the basement. Mm. The story has to have a basement,
like a foundation,
a house. You know, if a house doesn't have a foundation, you know, it's kind of, you know, it can disappear. You know, it's not solid. So this solidity of the foundation of the film, it's a thematic concern. What is actually the film really about? It's not about this. It's not about the plot.
Right.
It's not about the story even, right? Because the story is like communicates something which is like beyond or above the story or like. So if I see that the films don't engage me, you know, either intellectually or emotionally, or you know, if a comedy, for example, you know, if it doesn't, if there is no, you know, there is no flow, there is no exchange. I think the exchange is a very good keyword, not only to the cinema, but basically to everything.
Like when you say exchange, do you mean like a relationship with the viewer? Or do you mean...
There is something like, you know, when you watch a movie, it has to be this exchange, what I'm talking about, is between your engagement in the film and the film and something that film proposes to you. Because film is always a proposition. It's always an offer or proposition or something. It's nothing which is like a work of art. That it's work of art is always a proposition. Okay, I propose something, and I'm not saying that it's complete, that it's perfect, but it's my proposition.
Right. So you say you like to ask audiences questions at Q&As. Is that kind of what you're doing as a filmmaker? Do you think you're asking questions of me as a viewer? You're asking questions of a culture, of a society, of a way of life, a worldview.
Especially in this film, you know, because it's very personal to me. It's about the subject that it's personal. I only make a movies about something that I know, or I went through, or some experience that I'm never autobiographic, you know, because if you're autobiographic, you're almost pornographic, you know, you quote yourself. So. But I think every experience, you know, that's your tool as a filmmaker, as a director, your experience. That's kind of sublimated in the stories, in the projects, you know. So when I use this experience in a film, what I want you to do, it's not that I'm asking a question, but I make you aware that there are certain things important for me, you know. It's a dramaturgy, for example. Dramaturgy is an incredible tool, filmmaking tool, that the thematic concern that I have, that I want to pass it through to you, it needs to be dramatized, right? It needs to have a drama. That's the basic element of every storytelling, dramaturgy, you know? And a drama, what I see that people kind of confuse with emotions. Hmm. You know, but drama is not about emotions. Dramaturgy is about... it's about the relationship... It's about the relationship between people, you know. Dramaturgy is actually the biggest mystery of writing, of editing, of making movies. Hmm. That you have a feeling that it's something has passed through, that it's a certain kind of content, a meaning,
that
the meaning is formulated. You know, actually, the director is the person. Other name for the director is the sense maker, someone who makes sense.
Right. Meaning. It's good. It's interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you're talking kind of to me anyway. You're talking about an existential kind of intention, like an authorial intention, mm-hmm. right? That comes from within.
Yeah.
Right. It's not technical necessarily. It's out of, like you, as you said, it's out of your experience. That's one of the tools that you bring.
Yeah. That also has to be like kind of it also has to be kind of an impulse. People say like. You hear directors saying like, "Oh, I'm dying to make this film. I'm dying to make it. It's really this is the right impulse, you know, to make a film. It's like if you don't make this film, then you're gonna explode."
Right. So tell us about this movie, Beyond Words. And by the way, congratulations.
Thank you.
And if I forget, wishing you well with the premiere tonight and the Q&A and all. And I hope you get an opportunity to ask a question or two of the audience. So the film is not about the story, you say, that you see up on the screen necessarily, but it's about something else. It's about something other. And in this film, Beyond Words, there's lots of words, and yet there's not a lot of words. It almost strikes me as a minimalist kind of a dialogue in a way, and very intentional, I would think, on your part.
Because I know four languages, right? And what's for me, for example, one of the characteristics of someone who is immigrant is like, for example, I write, think, dream, talk in four different languages.
Right. So
for example, in my dreams, my mother talked to me in English. No, which is real, because she always knew, she only knew one language, Polish. So this kind of language vertigo, you know, it's always very characteristic for the immigrant. It's also this kind of detachment, existential kind of state, you know, that you have, you are locked inside in a way. As an immigrant, you also have this kind of double. Two aspects of your identity. There's the inner identity, so what I think about myself, right? But there's also this outer identity. So how people see me and how I think how people see me.
Right, right.
So, so if I think that people see me as Dutch and I see that people react to me as a Dutch person, so it's normal for me to think, so I'm Dutch, right? And then suddenly, you know, one day I'm reading about myself in the newspapers, and I'm a Polish woman living in Amsterdam. So I say, hey, it's a kind of, so, you know, it's like this identity of an immigrant. It's kind of it's so natural for you, for example, then you can say, okay, I'm a Canadian.
Right. Or,
but for me, it's not so much if I'm Polish or Dutch, but basically who I am. That's the big question for me. You know? And in this film, because we started to talk about dialogues in this film, for me, as an immigrant, to say something, to communicate something, you have to understand that I kind of translated or looking for the right words in all the four languages that I know. So sometimes, for example, I really regret that I cannot use the Russian word. You know, there are some Russian words that are like exactly spotless. You know that. But in this film, the dialogues that what people tell each other, they are actually very important, but they don't touch exactly the essence of the.
So is meaning then beyond words? Is that kind of the point to some degree, or one of the messages that you're communicating in this film?
Yes, it's beyond words, but it's not about how people. You know, interpret this film that it's beyond words because of this immigrant film, you know, immigrant team. It's beyond words because the communication between the two characters, this father and son, it can never succeed, actually, right? These two guys are bound by blood, but not by past. There is nothing between them, so they are two strangers. So, basically, how can you... Okay, there's a father who is a stranger, but it has all the symbolic meaning of, you know, of being a father, right? Mm-hmm. But he's also like the symbolic meaning of father. He's also the imaginary, right? What Lacan was saying, imaginary, symbolic, and real. But he's also real. So he's this guy, you know, kind of washed out and not very successful in life. And so this tree.
Who's supposedly been dead for a few years.
Who's supposedly been dead from the.
As far as his son is concerned,
his son always was growing up believing that his father was dead, and when he found out, when he found out that he had a father, so the character, the kind of person that he is, and I call him like self-made man, like the character of Red and Black, you know, like someone who aspires, he sees being German as a kind of the aspiration of something that he deserves, you know, that he works hard to be treated as German and to be seen as German. But also like in the Red and Black, you know, he aspires to something, but deep down he also kind of dislikes what he aspires to.
Right, right.
Which is, is basically a great recipe for for the catastrophe, right?
Right, right, sure, sure, for disaster.
Recipe for a disaster.
Catastrophe is a good word. So Michel is a Polish newcomer to Germany, learning the language, interviewing another newcomer to Germany, and deciding whether or not that person, as a lawyer, that person is allowed to, well, or that not allowed to come into the country, but to take his case.
Doesn't make a chance.
He's not even gonna, right. So, I mean, the ironies abound.
Yeah, the irony is basically that the film opens with almost like a chess.
Such a beautiful shot, too, by the way. The opening shot of the film that's just so gorgeous. Of him against it.
Against the wall with his bullets.
Bullet holes, they are bullets. I wondered.
Bullet holes. This is the place. It's the oldest, one of the oldest places in Berlin. It was the last place that the fighting was taking
place. Is that right?
In the Second World War. Everybody who was fighting there in this building died. And there was also, near this building, there were also the graves of the German soldiers. We were not allowed to even come closer there. You know, it was very highly respected, but the place has. I was thinking, like, when I saw this place, I thought, like, wow, this incredible irony that a guy who works in an environment that's all about money, he lives in such a close proximity of sacrum, that he hears the church bells 4 times a day.
Right.
You know, it's kind of irony. You know, he should know better.
Right. Right.
And he's so close. You know, in the beginning, when you have this, the beginning of the film is kind of a chess-like contrast between very, very white guy and can I use it the word black guy? Because the African people who are playing in my film, I had a very interesting discussion, you know, about political correctness, you know.
Right.
So, for example, what I found out that how little we know, a European, about African languages.
Sure.
I didn't know that there are something like 600 languages in Africa. And they are like basic.
Pretty remarkable.
Basic languages.
How nuanced and subtle it must be, right?
And we know nothing.
And we know nothing, exactly.
We know nothing about their literature, and that's you know.
And Ursula, isn't that the posture kind of to take? I mean, I think, you know, having worked in development and so on for years and traveled to quite a few different countries, I think, you know, this idea of listening, you know, take a posture where you know nothing, keep your mouth, you know, you're beyond words, right? Shut your mouth and hear the other, listen to the other, really listen to the other, and then maybe we can start to understand.
Yeah, because when I went to the poetry slam, Black Poetry Slam in Berlin, and then we saw, poets, mostly from Nigeria, but also from other African countries. It was fantastic, you know, people were like on a stage, reciting poems with music. But after it, I was speaking to these people, and I learned, oh my God, they have, Nigerian culture. I mean, they have literature. Man. They have the whole film industry. They know nothing at all. You know, they were quoting films and series and actors and writers. You know, and we were like white people, and we were like, we know nothing. I felt so stupid. You know, like.
Nigeria is a huge country and one of the most, one of the biggest economic successes, I think, in Africa, actually. I was talking to somebody recently about the growth, not only population-wise, but economically as well.
Though.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. So contrast for you is incredibly important. There's so many lovely, gorgeous shots in your film. Remarkable. But when Michel is interviewing this new, I guess, potentially new German.
let's see
what happens. But there's this, the way you frame this with the two windows and what appears to be almost, it's not a bar, but the wall. I mean, it just really sets up these two opposing worldviews.
It's very contrasting,
very sort of, almost ready to, for conflict, you
but
know?
Both these guys, they basically believe in the same.
Exactly, right. Well, and we don't know, I don't think, at that point, that the guy who's interviewing him is also an
immigrant.
Yeah.
So it's, but what it was actually an idea of my cameraman, not to put a translator in the scene, but to put it, you know,
through
the phone.
It's really interesting.
I was always jealous, you know. I was like, why didn't I have this idea? This is a great idea. This is like this voice, you know.
It's that, like a voice, this omniscient voice or something. It's really interesting.
It kind of comes from I don't know where. And it has this very
must be the CIA.
That's what it kind of godly authority.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So do you see things like that in juxtaposition? Do you see things in contrast, kind of black, white, up, down? You don't strike me as a polarized person.
No.
Like, you don't. Way more nuance, way more complexity and subtlety.
Way more layered, let's say.
Way more layers, yeah.
But what I've read somewhere, it's a very nice line. It says, everything is lit up more in a contrast.
Mm.
Which is very nice, you know.
Interesting,
everything is
yeah.
lit up more in a contrast. So,
sure, sure.
So I was thinking why identity is a very shadowy concept.
Sure,
there's
sure,
a lot
sure.
of layers and definitions, but being loved or not loved is like either this or the 0-1, right?
So, right, right.
So I thought, like, okay, the problem of the main character is not if he's Dutch, if he's Polish, if he's German, or like for me, if I'm Dutch or Polish, it doesn't matter. But I think the problem of the deep reason behind the immigration of the main character was being unloved.
Mm.
I'm thinking, like, if you're not loved as a child, you want to, as a grown up, you want to be loved by the whole world.
Right.
And you just need this love. And I think this Michiel thought, like, I mean, not like thought, like reasonably thought, but maybe the idea in him, in the back of his head, was like, okay, I wasn't loved by my father. I make myself, so not the nature, but the nurture, I make myself anew. I use this immigration as a kind of heroic ethos of immigration. You can
sure.
go and you can make yourself anew.
Fresh start. Yeah. Yep.
Fresh start, but it's also kind of, you can create yourself. You can create yourself
right.
again
right.
with a different...
Right. Right.
Basically, you create a German version of yourself.
Right.
So
right.
it's you, but in a German version. So the self-creating element is heroic, but it's also not really complete. The guy is not complete until he doesn't see his father, doesn't recognize his face,
well,
the face of other men.
And what I love about it, and also what is unsettling to me, is that this in the scene where the father genuinely seems to be reaching out and hugging him, and the son just does not reciprocate. There's just no way. His hands are at his side, and so there's clearly some pretty deep scars, deep emotional pain.
You know, I interpret it this way. Every time when my parents came to me to Holland, and I'm coming from a simple background, I would say, like, not poor, because growing up in communism, I cannot say that I was poor. My both parents were working. My father was working in a steel mill. My mother in a factory. But it's, you know, it's something like when they were coming to me to visit me, it was very confrontational. It's always like a primal scene of immigration, visit of your parents, right?
Right.
And then you see like how much you changed, what the big difference is between you and your parents. And it's also in my case, I crossed the Rubicon of a social status, right? I moved to a different social class. So when my parents were coming visiting me, it became very very obvious, you know, that there is a contact between.
Sure.
But there are certain things that I cannot explain to them. They are cut off from some experience of mine, from my joys, from my, you know.
It's the classic child, son or daughter saying, oh, you'll never understand, right, to their
parents. But in this case, with the social context, it's kind of harrowing, you know.
Mm.
That of course, they were happy about my successes, but you know, I was growing up in, me and my sister were the first people in my family who were buying books, you know, going to schools to study.
Sure.
So it's... But this, so what I was, my idea was for the main character that he's not so empathic towards the father, is more that he needs empathy, but it's pretty much like his father, that he wants empathy, he can even show empathy, but he cannot take off, doesn't want to take responsibility for empathy. If you show empathy, you have to take responsibility. You cannot just show it, you know, you have to, it comes with responsibility. And both these guys, neither the father nor the son, they're pretty much the same, you know, they wanted something, and they are lovable people, I mean, especially the father, right? But even he cannot, like, take responsibility for what he offers,
right.
Right. For the emotions that he offers, you know. But there's also something else that I think when you're an immigrant, and basically every day before you go outside and you join this Dutchies or Germans, you know, like, you prepare yourself, you know. It's like in this film, you know, he repeats with German words, you know.
Right, basically, right.
He's practicing, you know. He
pronunciation.
He puts his armor, you know. The words are also armor, you know. He's like a knight, you know, that goes out and. But it takes a lot of power and a lot of, you know, persistence to keep yourself together, you know, like this, with this language, with this your different identity. So when your parents come, you know, and showing them empathy. It's basically, every time when my parents came, I had like a 1 week after they left, I was like in pieces, emotionally. You know, it's like two films, you know, there's their film and my film, and now suddenly these two films like intervene with each other, you know, and what I'm supposed to do now, you know, in which film I am now, you know, like, and it's also the emotional price that I have to pay, you know, by showing this empathy. So I think this Michael kind of protects himself because he thinks, like, if I show empathy to this guy who's practically a stranger, he's my father, okay?
Well, and there's a sense to me too, Ursula, in the story where Michael wants to totally detach himself from his past. Like, he's done. So when his father comes over and I think he's standing on the balcony, he said, there's nothing Polish.
There's nothing Polish
in here. You know, there's no artifacts, there's no art, there's no nothing. You've got nothing of your past, in a sense. Is that directly related to his identity? And then his partner says to him when he's talking to his father in Polish, which I also love, that's that scene where he says, "Oh, you're a different person when you speak in Polish."
It's more like a child.
More like a child, yes.
That he goes, he kind of almost like automatically maybe this is what the film is really about, that what this father does to him, he kind of sends him back to the state of being a child, you know. He makes him vulnerable.
He makes him vulnerable again.
And so he cannot, like,
uncertain,
vulnerable.
This is a guy all about precision, right? The way he irons his clothes,
control
and very controlled.
Power, right?
Yes.
And then this father creates kind of an emotional vertigo, leaves him, and then he's supposed to return to his life. He will never do that, you know, because it's like something is not really transformed or changed, but something is opened in him. The emotions of a child who was unloved, the emotion of a self-made man. Let's call him by the name. I mean, he's a narcissist, right? I mean, the guy who asked his father, "So, are you proud of me?"
It's
a half child, half narcissist.
So the scene near the we're gonna have to wrap it up in a couple of minutes. But the scene near the end where he seeks violence. He goes out after violence. You know, he's like he's physically demonizing the other when he knows somewhere that this has got to be wrong. Well, he's seeking it. Is that his attempt at, like, self-flagellation? Like, he's, you know, some sort of working out his own shame and guilt, you know,
by picking a fight? In a scene before, you know, the guy, his friend, his boss, told him, like, look, maybe you think that you're German, but you will never be German.
Right.
You know, you belong to this group where you always belong, and this group is immigrants, right? And actually, the group of immigrants where you don't want to belong, but you do, has these two sides. You know, you are on the one side of the spectrum because you are very white and you can always pass for a German. But there is the other side of the spectrum, and there's this black guy. He can never hide. He wears his otherness on his sleeve, right? And even better, he's proud of it.
He's proud of it,
right?
Yeah. So and writes guy, poetry about it.
Right. I mean, it's like pretty much relaxed about it and proud, you know. So this Michael actually cannot understand how it's possible. How do people live, right? Like how? Why do I have to, like? Why this edge in me, you know, to to disappear among other people. Why these black people, they don't want to disappear. They actually, you know, the last scene, you know, the end of the film takes place in Neukölln, this district in Berlin. And it wouldn't be strange if this guy, you know, who's living in Charlottenburg, you know, this kind of fancy place, that he might never been in this Neukölln. Because Neukölln is basically a place where a lot of, multicultural things. So he has nothing to look for there in this place, you know.
Right,
so
right.
He goes there like almost like he's kind of spitted out to a rail.
Yes, yes.
And that's a rail.
Yes.
You are one of them, right? So basically, it's not... Actually, the very interesting question I hope to ask people tonight is if they think that the main character is a racist.
Mm.
This is a very interesting question.
It is a very interesting question.
Because basically how he thinks is like, wait a second, this black guy comes here to Germany and he thinks that he has the same rights that I have to work for these rights.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So
yes.
That's his thinking. And now the question is it racistic? I mean... It's like, it is. By the old definition, it is. But because of this film, you kind of come closer to this kind of person, right?
Sure, sure.
You know where it come from.
Well, you do have to ask the question as to why he was so vehement about saying, no, I don't want to take this case on. I'm not going to
Because he thinks like, probably this guy thinks like, oh, they're going to look so nice in court. You know, one immigrant is defending the other immigrant. Oh, it's so beautiful, you know. And he kind of despises it mm-hmm. because he mm-hmm. wants to be seen as German, right?
Yes, yes.
So that's the reason. And, of course, this is the very reason that he learns at the end of the film. Right? And then it comes to confrontation with his friend, but also his boss.
Yes, yeah.
So that's kind of in the real world, probably he won't be working anymore.
I have to ask you about the scene, the extended scene with his father, that Michel and his father in the strip club.
Mm-hmm.
Made me uncomfortable thinking about what that conversation would have been like if it had been my father and I. Which is maybe what you were hoping for. I don't know, but it was a pretty intimate scene
yeah.
between the two of them. They clearly bonded. They clearly had things to talk about.
Yeah, they kind of.
There was an intimacy there.
Yeah, there's intimacy. They kind of liked each other almost, and kind of accept each other.
Yes.
They kind of found each other like the guys can find each other. Oh, it's a nice guy. I could drink with him and I can have a laugh. You know, it's like, so there's almost like a camaraderie.
Yes,
like,
yes,
between
yeah.
the two guys, right?
Yeah.
And then he has this child slash. Question like. Basically, are you proud of me? And what this guy can tell him? He says yes and no at the same time. I am proud of you because you achieved this, but actually I'm not proud because what you achieved is just money.
Well, to that point earlier in the film, doesn't he say something to the fact, I wanted to give you something, but clearly you already have everything.
And this poor guy wants to give him this watch, which is have different value than money value, you know? It's a sentimental
yeah,
value.
Yeah, of course.
You know? Because you ask about why this character doesn't keep any Polish things in his apartment. I don't know if it was a Deleuze who said something about memories and reminders of memory, you know, that
reminders of memory is a great phrase.
Reminders of memory. No, it's like when you keep, for example, souvenirs.
Yes.
Right, from
yes,
a holiday.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think Deleuze was saying like, don't keep the souvenirs. I mean, let the past just pass. You know? Don't keep anything because you kind of you make an object out of
right,
the past.
Right. Right.
Right. Which is dead.
Which other Baudrillard, I don't know if you've read any Baudrillard, but if you're going to bring up
Baudrillard,
Deleuze,
yeah,
I'll bring up Baudrillard. But
yeah, I love
the whole
Baudrillard's
idea of
seduction,
hyper-reality and yeah. simulation and the whole idea of the image and the mechanically reproduced image, right?
So because
which is a funny conversation to have with a filmmaker.
Oh, I love Baudrillard. I was like in the 90s, I was trying to read everything.
Is that right?
Yeah. My third film was basically based off, not based, no, inspired by his book about seduction.
Ah, okay.
Fantastic.
Interesting.
I mean, if only feminists could read this book, you know, and learn some lessons from this guy, because he's saying incredible things.
He is saying incredible things. One of the harder guys to read that I've ever read. Next, maybe, maybe Heidegger, Immanuel Kant, I also found very difficult. Hegel, very challenging, without a doubt. I love the fact that Baudrillard can write one sentence and take up a whole page. That's what...
I like that he writes almost like a poet.
He does write almost like a poet, absolutely.
He writes evocative.
Which is really interesting, coming back to our sort of full circle to what we started talking about with respect to film and the language of film and intuition and feeling and emotion and so on. I want to try to bring it to a close here, sadly, but... there's a question that was kind of, for me, almost not out of left field, but a very ethical question that Michel's partner, I can't remember his name, said, you know, imagine coming to a country in a boat and it capsizes. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, that's classic lifeboat, lifeboat question.
Yeah.
Who are you going to help? Which is essentially the position of power that they're in.
Yeah.
Is that a question that is being asked in a meaningful way around the world, do you think? I mean, clearly Europe, the refugee crisis is a problem. It's a problem everywhere, right?
It's, I think, Badiou. Yeah, Badiou says, like, whoever is here is from here.
Whoever
is here is from here.
Right.
So
right,
it basically is right. Like, you are coming here, I'm from here.
Yes, okay. there are no immigrants.
There are no immigrants, right?
Yeah.
But then Slavoj Žižek says, like, yeah, it's very nice, but imagine that like the rest of the world outside of Europe think like that, and then it comes here and wants to say, like, it's nice that you have all this European value and this humanitarian value, but you want them too,
right?
And then it's like, I don't know, 10 million people comes with a very reasonable demand, right? We want the same rights as you. So this question is very important for this film. But indeed, like, who are you gonna help? You're gonna help by the heart or by the reasoning,
right?
For example,
right.
There is a great story, for example, during the occupation, during the Second World War, there were great efforts made to save a Jewish poet from the ghetto. There was a guy who was a poet. And actually, a lot of people, you know, were risking life to save the poet.
Mm.
I always remember this. It was really striking for me that there is in the ghetto is this mind, you know, that it's a kind of almost like an angel, you know, that we have to preserve him, because in him is like much more than just life, you know. So I thought, like, okay, now it's this boat, and now, if you ask me, I would always have a problem. But my heart would be like going maybe to a child or to an older person. You know, I don't have children, so I have this.
It's a question I don't think any of us really wants to ever ask if it has to play out in the real world. But I think it is a question worth asking of students and our children and our parents. And it's something to think. It is something to think about. And I think it's why
not even to arrive at answer,
at an answer. Like, no, absolutely. It's about that conversation and being able to say, I have actually thought through some of these things. And I mean, if more of our politicians were reflecting on these kinds of questions in a meaningful way, I think we'd be in a better place. Wow, a little too idealistic. We'd be in a different place.
we would be prepared. You know?
We'd be prepared. There you go. Nice.
For some things that might happen in life.
It's good. I love this idea of preparation. What a nice way to sort of end the interview. And thank you so much for your time today. Talking with Ursula Antoniak about her new film, Beyond Words, world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.